AFP Audio is today talking to Dr. Dipti Salalika, who is a staff specialist haematology at Canberra Hospital, senior lecturer at the Australian National University, and member of the Medical and Scientific Advisory Group of the Myeloma Foundation. Welcome, Dipti.
Thanks, Carolyn.
So, Dipti is one of the authors of a focus article found in the 2013 edition of Australian Family Physician on multiple myeloma from diagnosis to treatment. And the theme of this month is diagnostic challenges, and multiple myeloma is a condition that can present in such a myriad of ways and needs to be considered to be diagnosed. The article starts by making the point that multiple myeloma is a plasma cell malignancy. Can you tell us a little about what it is and what distinguishes it from the precursor lesions?
Sure. So multiple myeloma, it's also known as plasma cell myeloma, and it's quite a common hematological malignancy in the elderly. So the median age at presentation is usually about 65 to 70 years, and it's got quite a significant disease burden in Australia. There are more than, I think, about 1,000 cases diagnosed in our country every year. But importantly, if there is a delay in diagnosis, it can cause end organ damage that can be irreversible. So it is important to know about the condition and also to recognize the constellation of symptoms and findings in patients quite early on. Like you mentioned, it is a malignancy of plasma cells. And if I can just talk about what plasma cells actually are, they are terminally differentiated B lymphocytes, and their main role, like we all know, is to produce antibodies to mount an immune response against infections. When these cells undergo a malignant change, these monoclonal plasma cells can accumulate in the bone marrow and also produce a monoclonal protein called an M protein or paraprotein, which basically expresses the same immunoglobulin chains. Now, these monoclonal plasma cells and the M protein then have the potential to affect quite a number of organs and cause end organ damage. There are three main types of plasma cell malignancies, the multiple myeloma or plasma cell myeloma, which is usually symptomatic, and two precursor lesions, which are known as MGUS or monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, and smoldering myeloma. Now, there's one thing that actually differentiates a plasma cell myeloma from MGUS or smoldering myeloma, and that is the presence of end organ damage. I always tell the medical students and registrars it's quite easy to remember these using the acronym CRAB, so C-R-A-B, where C stands for hypercalcemia, A for anemia, R for impaired renal function, and B for bony disease. On the other hand...
So they'd be the sort of things that would make us think about it. What are some of the, as you said, the CRAB acronym is a really good one. How would we then suspect it, and when should we, what sort of triggers might a GP see that might make them think about it in a patient?
It can be quite varied, the clinical presentation. Some patients come with quite poorly defined or minimal symptoms, whereas others can have an acute presentation which is quite dramatic with pathological fractures or acute renal failure or symptomatic anemia or even hypercalcemia sometimes. Anemia is quite common, but that can be asymptomatic. And we often get referrals for just mild anemia that might be normocytic, normochromic, but sometimes also macrocytic. And then we evaluate the patient further and find that the patient has an overt myeloma. Renal failure, again, can be asymptomatic or chronic, but sometimes can have an acute presentation with oliguria and urea. And again, further testing is required if the renal failure cannot be readily attributable to another cause. In terms of bony disease, which is one of the most common symptom that we tend to see, more than half the patients will have some sort of a symptom related to bony disease, and the most common of this is really back pain. If you look at bony disease, it's characterized by lytic lesions in the bones, and understandably, those who have quite large lytic lesions or who are quite osteoporotic can develop pathological fractures when they are faced with minimal trauma. So that's certainly one of the presentations that should make you suspect the diagnosis of myeloma. Symptomatic hypercalcemia is only seen in a small minority of cases, but it can again be quite dramatic sometimes with confusion, muscle weakness, etc., etc. So yeah, that's
so they're the types of things that should make us think about it. If we are considering the diagnosis, are there some investigation, and particularly if it's also one of the less dramatic presentations like a mild anemia or impaired renal function as opposed to the lytic bony disease causing pathological fracture. If we're considering the diagnosis, what sort of investigation should a GP organise?
Okay. So a diagnosis of myeloma is based on three main findings. The first of these is detection of clonal plasma cells in the bone marrow. The second feature is a paraprotein that is detected either in the blood or in the urine. And the third is the presence of end organ damage. And we've talked about this in the previous question. But basically, our investigations need to be geared towards these three main findings. So some of the tests that need to be performed to confirm the diagnosis are actually performed by the specialist hematologist. But quite a number of the investigations can be performed by the GP to accompany the referral. And this then becomes quite valuable when the patient's being evaluated subsequently. So what are the baseline investigations that are needed? A full blood count and blood film if they have not been done before. Liver function tests, particularly albumin and total protein. Lactate dehydrogenase level. Renal function tests, including a urea and a creatinine. Electrolytes should be performed and calcium and phosphate levels also should be requested. Serum immunoglobulins also have to be measured. One of the features that we talked about was the detection of paraprotein, and the investigations we use there are protein electrophoresis and immunofixation. So immunofixation will not only increase the sensitivity of detection of paraprotein, but it will also tell us about the nature of the paraprotein. So it'll basically give us information about the class of immunoglobulin, whether it's an IgG, an IgM, or an IgA. And also what light chain is actually expressed by the paraprotein. And this becomes quite important afterwards in monitoring the disease after treatment is commenced. Now, you can perform these studies not just on blood samples, but also on urine samples, and there it should preferably be a 24-hour collection.
Yep.
So in some cases, these studies are usually adequate, but in some cases, you might not. These protein studies might still not pick up a paraprotein. So there is a more sensitive test called the serum-free light chain, which basically measures not intact paraprotein but just the light chain component of it. But this should preferably be done in consultation with the hematologist.
And so, say that someone is referred with either a diagnosis or a suspicion of the diagnosis. What are the other tests that a hematologist might arrange?
The main test that a hematologist will do would be a bone marrow biopsy, and that's to assess the clonal plasma cell burden. So in myeloma, we tend to see plasma cells that are variably increased. Normally, they're less than 5% in normal bone marrow, but they can be increased. And in the most severe cases, we do find quite extensive infiltrates of the plasma cells replacing normal hematopoietic precursors in the bone marrow, and we've got a picture of that in the article, so you can have it. The plasma cells are actually quite pretty cells, quite beautiful. Doesn't do very nice things in the marrow, but they look quite nice under the microscope. So besides assessing the bone marrow morphologically, we'll also do some additional tests to assess the clonality of the plasma cells by flow cytometry. We sometimes use other ancillary investigations. And we also, importantly, determine the cytogenetic changes that are seen in the plasma cells, because that gives us an idea of the prognosis in the patient. That just reminds me, there's probably another thing that would be quite valuable for general practitioners to do before they refer the patient, and that's to request a skeletal survey. So this is a routine X-ray of multiple bony sites, and you just write on the form skeletal survey, and it'll assess for lytic lesions.
Yep.
And one more thing that a GP can initiate is a visit to a dentist, because we tend to start these patients on bisphosphonates, and it's quite important to get all the necessary dental work done prior to commencing treatment with these agents, because they can cause osteonecrosis of the jaw, which can be quite difficult to treat afterwards.
Yep. Okay. So the diagnosis has been made, and one of the things obviously people often wonder about is, after they get a diagnosis like this, what are some of the things that might tell me how good or bad this type of myeloma is? What are some of the prognostic features you look for?
Right. So the most commonly used prognostic marker is called the International Prognostic Index, and it's quite a simple index which only uses two parameters, which is the albumin level and beta-2 microglobulin. And we use a numerical cutoff that is similar for both of them, so 3.5 grams per liter for albumin and 3.5 milligrams per liter for beta-2 microglobulin. And we get three prognostic groups there. Patients with stage 1 disease have normal levels of both, and we'd expect them to have an overall survival of about, say, 5 years, whereas stage 3 disease is those patients who have abnormalities in both albumin and beta-2 microglobulin, and their median survival is significantly lower, so a little about 2 years or so.
Okay, so say someone has symptomatic myeloma, and as you point out, the prognosis can vary depending on the stage. What are the management options that they might be offered?
So this tends to vary not only with the age of the patient, but also with the presence of the comorbidities that the patient might have, and also how bad the disease is. Our main thing is to establish if a patient is likely to be eligible for an autologous peripheral blood stem cell transplant, so that's the mainstay of treatment. And most patients who are less than 65 years of age or sometimes fit older patients, they would be considered eligible for transplant. So in those cases, we treat patients with about 3 to 6 cycles of induction treatment, and that can be with multiple drugs, before they undergo their stem cell transplant. Again, the choice of the induction agent tends to vary based on the age, the nature of the disease, and the comorbidities of the patient. So, for example, if you've got high risk or advanced myeloma, or patients who have renal failure, for example, they should preferably receive a drug called bortezomib or Velcade, whereas those who have peripheral neuropathy need to be treated with a lenalidomide-based regimen. Again, there are different drugs we would use in patients who have past or present history of thromboembolic disease. So, it tends to vary.
And that would clearly be a decision the hematologist would make. So people who are able to have a transplant, that's a sort of first, also, the fitter, younger, weller people would be looking at a transplant. Perhaps what are some of the options regarding perhaps some of the more elderly or frail patients?
Yeah, so our main goal of treatment is really to reduce the tumor burden as rapidly and efficiently as possible. In younger patients, what we are trying to do is get a good outcome from the autologous transplant, and that happens if you reduce the disease burden. But in patients who are older or frail, like you said, and are ineligible basically for autologous stem cell transplants, we still treat them with induction regimen. And there's a drug called melphalan, which is often used in combination with some of the newer agents that are now on the market. That would be the mainstay of treatment. But obviously, there's a lot of supportive measures that are required as well. We'd give infection prophylaxis. We'd give thromboembolism prophylaxis to the patient. If they have bony disease, we'd be managing that. Prophylactic bisphosphonates are used in almost all cases. So there's a lot that goes on for quite a few months once patients are diagnosed with myeloma.
Okay. And so we've sort of talked a bit about the management of myeloma. Early on, we mentioned the precursors, smoldering myeloma and MGUS. What's the follow-up plan for those conditions?
Yeah, so I think where myeloma is symptomatic, the precursor lesions, the MGUS and the smoldering myeloma are asymptomatic. So they tend to be diagnosed on the basis of an incidental finding of paraprotein. But there's really no need to treat these patients because they just have to be monitored carefully. They're not really symptomatic from their disease. And you're monitoring mainly to watch for progression of the disease to overt myeloma because that's the point at which you need to treat. So depending on the nature of the MGUS or the smoldering myeloma, a 3 to 12 monthly monitoring approach would generally be adopted by the hematologist. So that would be what would be done.
Okay. So in conclusion, what are a few key points that you think it's important for GPs to recall about multiple myeloma?
So I guess the first thing really is that it can present quite a difficult diagnostic issues because patients can present with a wide variety of presenting symptoms. So it's important to have a high degree of suspicion for myeloma, particularly when a patient presents with unexplained symptoms or findings, for example, a crush fracture or a bony pain in a young person. Say you've got a hypercalcemia with a normal parathyroid hormone level. If you've got an anemia or macrocytosis with normal hematinics, for example, or if you've got renal impairment and you cannot attribute it to any other cause, it's worthwhile looking for myeloma. The second thing really to remember is what the diagnosis rests on, and that's three things: identifying a monoclonal paraprotein in the blood or urine, confirming the presence of myeloma-related organ or tissue injury, and documenting that there are clonal plasma cells in the bone marrow. Treatment-wise, there is a lot that has changed in recent years with the newer immunomodulatory agents and proteasome inhibitors that have come on the market. And myeloma patients do tend to do quite well now compared to their predecessors. I guess I'll probably end by saying that the role of the general practitioner is very crucial in helping to make an early diagnosis and basically allowing patients to be identified and treated without unnecessary delays.
Excellent.
I think that's probably the take-home message.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Deepti, and I'll remind people that they can read the full article in the October 2013 edition of Australian Family Physician. Thank you.
Can I also just say, Carolyn, that those who want to know more about the disease can refer to the MSAG clinical practice guidelines. These can be found on the Myeloma Foundation website.
Excellent. So if people want further information, the Myeloma Foundation website's a great place to look.
Absolutely.
Thank you.